he had already done.
Oh, that's all right, Tom, the boss said. Finish it up Monday. Your money will be ready when you finish.
From then on, Tom Doss was a devout Adventist and a determined Sabbath keeper. And the strange thing was that from that point on, he always had plenty of work, Monday through Friday. It was the turning point for the Doss family.
So you see, Desmond told Glenn, winding up the story, God took care of things in his own way, and it all worked out just right.
Well, you still do a lot of things I don't want to do, Glenn said. You really make it rough on yourself. You send 10% of your paycheck to your church. You wouldn't smoke a cigarette or take a drink if your life depended on it. You won't even eat a pork chop.
It's all written in the Bible, yours as well as mine, Desmond said. Pork is unclean, so is shellfish. I don't know what either one tastes like, so it isn't much of a hardship not to eat them.
Yeah, but the Bible doesn't say one word about cigarettes or bourbon whiskey.
Maybe not, but in his first letter to the Corinthians, Paul said, Ye are the temple of God. That's what we go on, that the body is the temple of God, and we won't defile the temple with nicotine or alcohol or even coffee or tea. I don't think I'm missing much there, either. I used to smoke corn silk cigarettes when I was a kid, and sometimes took a cigarette butt, but all they did was make me cough. One time I took some cough syrup for a cold, and the alcohol in it made me so dizzy I couldn't stand up. Once was enough.
Again, Desmond paused. How could he explain to this happy-go-lucky buddy of his that, even if the abstinences did seem harsh, the positive attributes of Adventism made such minor sacrifices worthwhile? He was no gloomy Gus. Adventists are a happy group of people. They work toward a goal, a positive, attainable goal, with a reward so great that the imagination can hardly picture it. For the Adventist also takes literally the word of Christ in the 24th chapter of Matthew, 14th verse. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. They interpret this to mean that when the word of the coming Christ has been made known to everyone, then Christ will come again. The world will end, and the faithful, those who have led Christian lives and made it possible for the gospel to be spread, will live in a heavenly happiness that is absolute, forever. The Adventist has the unmatchable goal of complete security throughout eternity.
Isn't that worth a cigarette? Or a drink of liquor? Or a shrimp cocktail?
Desmond asked. And Glenn smiled his golden smile, punched his buddy lightly on the arm, and suggested they start over to the mess hall for chow. Out of such discussions grew greater understanding. Another result, of great benefit to the men of Company B, was the arrangement by which Glenn worked Saturdays for Doss so that he could go to church, and Doss worked Sundays for Glenn so that he could go to Mass. Instead of a reluctant medic on duty against his will, the men of the company found an eager, solicitous young man on hand every day in the week. It became a part of the esprit de corps of the company. The men stopped going to the battalion infirmary for minor ailments, preferring to stay with their buddies, confident that their three conscientious medics would take good care of them right there in the company area. Now the entire division was beginning to pull together as a team. It was shaping up into a fine fighting unit with spirit and pride. It was sent on for further training, to the Louisiana maneuvers for simulated combat conditions, to Arizona for desert training, to Pennsylvania and West Virginia for mountain training. Dorothy followed Desmond wherever she could. In Louisiana, the only place she could find to stay was a dreary room in a dilapidated farmhouse. Another soldier's wife shared the same room. When their husbands could join them, the two couples divided the room by hanging a blanket down the middle. One Sabbath, the division was 25 miles from Shreveport, the nearest town. Desmond hitchhiked a ride with a farmer in an old Ford, but after church he could find no way to get back. Military police picked him up and held him overnight along with a group of drunks and troublemakers. A truck from the regiment picked him up in the stockade next day, and he had to explain to his commanding officer that the only thing he had done wrong was go to church. By now, Major Steinman, commanding the medical battalion, had become so infuriated over the Sabbath issue that he refused to give Desmond his pass to go to church, refused him permission to ask for a pass again, and refused to allow him to go to a higher authority on the matter.
If you give me the slightest provocation, Doss, the major said, I'll have you court-martialed.
Desmond knew he meant it. The slightest misstep, and he was in trouble. He did not go into town to church that week. Dorothy was staying in the farmhouse nearby, and the two of them went out into a cow pasture and held their own services.
Though Desmond had now earned the respect of the men in B Company, he was still having a hard time with the officers of the medical battalion.
Even regimental and division officers got into the hassle. During an important field exercise in which several divisions were involved, Desmond, as usual, asked to be relieved of duties on the Sabbath and to be permitted to go to town to church. The next thing he knew, he was told to report to a dusty crossroads in the maneuver area. There, in a command car, were two full colonels, one lieutenant colonel, and a major, all waiting for this one soldier who only wanted to go to church. It was Lieutenant Colonel Thomas B. Manuel, the regimental executive officer, who did most of the talking. Desmond was respectful and very sorry that these high-ranking officers had to take time away from their important duties to discuss religion with a private. But he was adamant. He wouldn't play war on the Sabbath.
"But I thought you could take care of the sick and injured on the Sabbath," the colonel said.
"Yes, sir. I believe that it is permissible to do good on the Sabbath and give medical aid to anyone who needs it," Desmond said. "But, Colonel, we've run this very same exercise 4 times now, and nobody's been hurt yet."
Finally, the brass gave up and permitted him to go into town and take Dorothy to church. He hitched a ride with an ambulance, which took him to the camp. It was deserted, except for the guards. Desmond's barracks was locked up tight, except for one window right over his bed. Desmond considered this the result of direct intervention by God, for surely he would not want his devoted subject to go to young people's meetings sweaty and dirty in fatigues. Desmond carried on God's will by getting a fire ladder and crawling in that unlocked window. And just then, the guard came by. Desmond explained the situation to him from the window.
"Do you need that ladder to get out again?"
the guard asked.
"Well, no,"
Desmond said.
"Then I'm going to put it away before someone sees it and we both get in trouble,"
the guard said.
"Now, you hurry up and get cleaned and dressed and out of here."
Desmond appeared at the meeting that night, showered, shaved, and dressed in a fresh uniform. Dorothy was there, waiting for him. Together they gave thanks to the Lord for helping Desmond keep the Sabbath and attend church. The division moved to the desert country in Arizona, and after several weeks of maneuvers, settled down far out in the desert.
The nearest town was Buckeye, where Dorothy lived in the home of an Adventist doctor and his wife.
They had an air-conditioned home, the only comfortable place for miles. Desmond was able to get his Sabbath pass again, but how would he get to town? A railroad went by, but some soldier passengers had damaged a train, and soldiers were no longer permitted to ride. The only other way to leave camp was by truck across the desert, to Phoenix or Yuma, each 100 or so miles away. Buckeye was only 50. Desmond obtained permission from regimental headquarters to ride the train if the railroad would let him. The station agent was perfectly willing to sell a round-trip ticket to this clean-looking young man who only wanted to go to church. And so, every Friday, while the other members of the division who had received a pass were jouncing across the desert in trucks, Desmond rode into Buckeye by air-conditioned train and participated in quiet private services with Dorothy and a group of other young people. Desert training shortened tempers from the top to the bottom. It was a cruel experience that had deleterious effects on the entire division. At that time, the United States Army, influenced by operations in the North African desert, was placing extreme emphasis on reducing the amount of water used by troops. Water, this most common liquid, becomes a precious commodity when it is in short supply. Each unit was severely limited in the amount of water it could have each day. The water was delivered to the company area in 50-gallon drums in open trucks. Some of the precious stuff would slosh over on the sandy floor of the truck and run out under the tailgate. Men would run after the truck, catch the water in their helmets, and drink it. Mud, sand, and all. On long hikes over the vicious desert, men would fall out through sheer dehydration. Medics were not given extra water, and sometimes Desmond and the others had to share some of their own. Desmond was already severely penalized, for although his individual consumption was computed in the coffee and tea service at meals, he did not drink these either. Under such conditions, it was easy to get excited about water. One day, the men in the company came running to Desmond with the report that Lieutenant Gornto, who was temporarily in command, was making no provision to apportion out the water in the platoon's existing supply. This was a most important procedure. Each morning, at a certain time, the water trucks would come around to replenish the supply. Kitchen barrels and individual canteens should be filled from what was left in the company water containers before they were refilled. Otherwise, they would lose that much water.
"But the lieutenant's just sitting there, doing nothing," the men told Doss excitedly. "We gotta get that water!"
Though Doss was only a private, as a medical soldier, he had prescribed responsibilities in matters of sanitation and health. He looked into the situation and found out that the men were right. He then felt morally obligated to screw up his courage, approach the lieutenant, and tell him what to do. Gornto received him casually. He looked tired.
"Don't worry about it, Doss," he said. "I'll take care of it."
Doss saluted and left. But still nothing was done. It was now almost time for the trucks to arrive. Doss ran to the headquarters of the medical battalion to report the matter to a medical officer. The officer on duty happened to be a close buddy of Lieutenant Gornto's. Doss felt that the whole thing was an exercise in futility, but again he felt obligated to carry out the matter as far as he could. The medical officer listened to Doss's report. He was obligated to take some action in the matter, and he grudgingly assured Doss that he would do so. By the time Doss returned to the company area, Gornto had had the water distributed. It was a moral victory for Desmond, and the men respected him for it. Gornto never referred to it again, but Desmond was naturally somewhat uneasy with him from then on. It does not make for smooth relations with your platoon leader to blow the whistle on him. To make the episode still worse, what Doss had not known was that Gornto and his jeep driver, Edward J. Panic, had spent most of the night looking for the water truck. Gornto had known all along that it would be later than usual. The men of the 77th existed in an atmosphere of parched heat, irritability, misunderstanding, and distrust. Conditions were so miserable that desertion was common. Some men fled into the desert and were never seen again. Even one of the chaplains went AWOL. Only in such an environment could the next episode in Private Doss's War with the Army have taken place. Going into the hot headquarters tent of the medical battalion to pick up his pass one Friday, he noticed that the chairborne commandos, the pencil pushers, were giving each other knowing looks. The top sergeant, who reflected with magnification the commanding officer's disapproval of Doss, handed over the pass with an unpleasant grin.
"I won't be doing this much longer, Doss," he said. "Arrangements are being made so that you can have all your Saturdays off from now on."
Something was in the wind. Desmond knew. He went to one of the officers of the battalion to find out what was going on.
"Ho, ho, ho, I got good news for you, Doss," he said. "You're getting out of the army. We've discussed your case at length and have come to the conclusion that you are eligible for discharge under the terms of Section 8. You'll appear before the discharge committee this morning. Go to your tent. You'll be summoned when they're ready for you."
Desmond's spirits went up, then down. He was human, and he had had enough of this desert. His nose was swollen and inflamed from the constant dust. His eyes were watering. The officers were down on him. He could never relax. He'd had enough. He was ready to go home. But Section 8, he knew, referred to mental instability, and Desmond Doss did not believe that, just because he wanted to go to church on Saturday, he was a nut. The discharge committee, composed of 5 medical officers, sat around a folding table out in the open. The papers were already made out. The chairman told Desmond what he already knew, that he was up for discharge.
Why Section 8?
He stammered. He was one lone private facing 5 military doctors who thought he was crazy. But what could he say?
"Hasn't my work been satisfactory?"
"Well, yes, it has,"
the chairman admitted.
"But everyone else in this unit is training 7 days a week. Your refusal to train with the rest of the men on Saturdays means that you are missing valuable training. You can miss something important which could keep you from doing your job properly. A man's life could be at stake. Even your own life could be in danger."
Desmond pointed out how he and Clarence Glenn had worked out an efficient system by which one of them was on duty during the weekend, and that Company B had the lowest number of men on sick call in the regiment. Committee members might as well not have heard him. Obviously, they wanted him to agree to accept the discharge without protest, but this he could not do.
"You say my work is satisfactory," he said. "So the only grounds you have for my discharge is my keeping the Sabbath. I'd be a very poor Christian to accept a discharge implying that I was mentally off purely because of my religion. When I'm called upon to treat my fellow soldiers on the Sabbath, I will do it, and willingly. I don't believe that I'm missing anything of importance by not being here on Saturdays. But if I do miss anything, even something that might endanger my life, well, I'll just take that chance."
Desmond paused for breath.
"Sir," he said softly, "please believe me. I know that if I keep God's commandments, he will give me wisdom and understanding equal to those who receive training on his holy day."
That answer stopped the Section 8 discharge right there. It was obvious that Washington would never approve a discharge given on purely religious grounds. Desmond remained in the army, on the desert. A strange victory. His situation was even worse than before, for it was all over the division that the officers of the medical battalion had tried to railroad a good soldier out of the army and had gotten themselves chewed out instead. This did not increase Desmond's popularity with the brass. Finally, now, this desert training hell was coming to a close. Word came down that the division's next stop would be the Indiantown Gap Military Reservation in Pennsylvania. Trees, grass, plenty of water, and no more sand. Elation swept through the entire division. At noon, Desmond Doss came in from the field, hot and dry, but happy in the knowledge that soon this would end. Waiting for him was an order to report to regimental headquarters, and there he was told that he had been officially transferred out of the medics into the headquarters company of the regiment. He was in the infantry again. His enemies in the medical battalion had gotten rid of him in another way. In a kind of daze, Desmond went to his tent to get his medical equipment and turn it in. Then he would report to his new company. He couldn't find a strap. Suddenly he realized that that one piece of canvas was all that stood between him and the infantry, and now his troubles were really beginning. He fell on his knees.
"Help me, O Lord," he begged. "Give me the wisdom so that I will know what to do."
He remembered Captain Stanley, who had helped him before. The missing strap gave him time to visit the chaplain, but Captain Stanley could give him only sympathy and good wishes. Finally, Desmond found the strap, and, knowing he was in for trouble, turned in his equipment. One of his friends, T-4 March Howell, told him goodbye.
"And say, Doss," Howell added, "I just made a $10 bet with your new company commander. He said he'd have you carrying a gun in 30 days.
I bet you wouldn't."
"You know I don't approve of gambling, Sergeant," Desmond said. "I don't want either one of you to lose, but I'm not going to carry a gun."
Desmond reported to his new company commander, Lieutenant Walter G. Costner. The lieutenant had been primed that the troublemaker was being transferred to his platoon, and he was ready for him. Doss was already assigned to the Pioneer Ammunition Section, and the carbine he was to carry was waiting for him.
"Private Doss," the lieutenant said, "take this carbine."
Desmond instantly realized the cat-and-mouse game the lieutenant was playing with him. Though as a conscientious objector he was officially exempt from bearing arms, no soldier is exempt from the obligation to obey the direct command of a commissioned officer. The lieutenant was out to make him either take the weapon or be court-martialed.
"I'm sorry, sir," Doss said, "but according to my religious convictions, I cannot bear arms."
Again, the lieutenant ordered Doss to take the rifle, and again Doss declined, phrasing his answer in such a way that it was not a direct refusal. The lieutenant tired of playing games with the rifle and picked up a .45 automatic pistol.
"You can take this, Doss," he said. "This isn't really a weapon."
"Then what is it, sir?" Doss asked.
The lieutenant played the game with a trench knife, then an ammunition kit. Doss declined both, again without making a direct refusal.
"Look, Doss," the lieutenant said, "I don't want you to kill anybody. I just want you to train with these weapons, like everybody else."
"I would rather put my faith in the Lord than confidence in a carbine," Desmond said.
The lieutenant leaned forward.
"You're married. Now, suppose somebody was raping your wife. Wouldn't you use a gun?"
"I wouldn't have one."
"What would you do, then?"
"I wouldn't just stand there," Doss said sharply. "I wouldn't use a gun, and I wouldn't kill, but he'd sure wish he was dead when I got through with him."
The conflict was interrupted by the move to Indiantown Gap. There, the lieutenant had the last word. Doss was placed on permanent KP and given the job of scrubbing the pots and pans. The unrelieved exposure to the harsh lye in the soap left his hands raw and bleeding. He was refused for a pass to leave the company area, which meant that it would be useless for Dorothy to come to Indiantown Gap. A telegram arrived from home. His younger brother, Harold, was home on his last furlough before going overseas with the Navy. This would be the last chance for the whole family to be together. About this time, several men in the platoon, including Doss, became eligible for a furlough, and they all put in for it. The lieutenant had the papers prepared and lined up the men, presenting each one with his papers. When he came to Doss, he placed the papers in his outstretched hand.
"Well, you haven't qualified with your weapon yet, have you, Doss?" he asked. "Well, there's a regulation that no man gets his furlough until he does."
He snatched the papers back and tore them up. Desmond went to the chaplain and all the way to the colonel of the regiment, but both told him there was nothing they could do. Sadly, he walked over to the telephone in the post exchange and called his family long distance.
"I can't come home," he said.
Then he choked up. He was in serious trouble. He might never see his brother again. He might never see any of his loved ones again. The way things were going, he could wind up in prison. He stood there, clutching the phone, unable to speak, as the seconds he was paying for ticked by.
"Desmond?"
his mother was crying.
"Desmond! What's the matter? Where are you? Desmond!"
Finally, he controlled himself and poured out the whole story.
Next morning, Desmond was up to his elbows in lye soap when he got word to report to the medical battalion. Major Steinman was waiting for him.
"Welcome back," he said.
The top sergeant said,
"Go report to your old company. You're back in the medics."
"Can I have a furlough?" Desmond asked, and explained his home situation. In any event, he was due a furlough. But things had not changed. Desmond would have to wait for a furlough. He could have a 3-day pass, in which case, no furlough.
"I'll take the pass," Desmond sighed.
He started for home immediately. When he arrived, he found out what had happened. His father had gotten in touch with Carlisle B. Haynes, chairman of the church's War Service Commission in Washington. Haynes called the regimental commander, Colonel Stephen S. Hamilton.
"I understand you're having some difficulty up there, Colonel," he had said pleasantly. "Is it necessary for me to come there and look into it?"
"Oh, no, not at all," the colonel said. "Whatever it is, we can straighten it out right here."
Desmond had been transferred back to the medics immediately after. However, just in case, Haynes sent to both the regimental commander and to Doss copies of documents signed by both President Roosevelt, Commander-in-Chief, and General George C. Marshall, Chief of Staff, affirming that conscientious objectors would not have to bear arms. With Desmond now definitely in the medical battalion, 307th Regiment, assigned to Company B, the division continued training at Indiantown Gap, a West Virginian training area, and at Camp Pickett, Virginia. Doss's unit drove up into the West Virginia mountains in open trucks wearing khakis and into 7 inches of snow. While they were training in the mountains there, a minor episode occurred which was to assume great importance later in combat. Several training periods were given over to learning how to tie knots, which would be useful in mountain climbing. Through his membership in the Junior Missionary Volunteers, Desmond was thoroughly familiar with the knots, but he pitched in and practiced just the same. One day there was a shortage of rope, and Doss did not have one to practice on. Two men were sharing one long rope, one at each end, and Desmond took the middle part, doubled it, and practiced with that. When he tied a bowline, a loop that will not slip, in the doubled line, he found that he had two loops rather than one, both held securely. He had never seen this done before, and he tucked it away in his mind. In the second week of March 1944, the 77th Division made its last move in the United States. Well-trained, at full strength, with good morale, and determined to prove themselves in battle, the men of the Statue of Liberty Division boarded special troop trains at Camp Pickett and headed west towards the Pacific and the Japanese. Dorothy, along with many other wives, was permitted to come to the company area to say goodbye. She and Desmond had said their goodbyes in the privacy of the camp guest house the night before. Now they could only look into each other's eyes and repeat again, "I love you. Ah, I love you." The next major city to the west was Lynchburg. Desmond was on KP, peeling potatoes in the baggage car, when he began to recognize landmarks on the outskirts of his hometown. He knew that the train would pass close to the Doss home. He also knew that his father liked to watch the trains go by. Desmond called the other men on KP with him, and they all got mops and brooms and stationed themselves in the open double doors. Sure enough, there was the familiar house and the familiar figure on the front porch.
"Okay, now!"
Desmond hollered, and his buddies began waving their mops and brooms. Mr. Doss waved back, with no idea that he was waving to his own son. On the spur of the moment, Desmond took a paper napkin and hastily wrote on it, "Dear Mom and Dad, I'm on the way. Pray for me." He tied a handkerchief around the paper, wrote his parents' name and address on the outside, and threw it off the train in hopes it would be found and taken to his parents. It was the next day. The train rattled on through Lynchburg, over a high trestle, toward the Pacific. Desmond looked longingly back at the scenes of his childhood. Two goodbyes in one day would take a lot out of any soldier. His spirits, already low, suddenly hit bottom. He had the sudden fear that he would never see his loved ones again. The train was still crossing over the trestle. "I might as well jump off," he thought disconsolately. Instead, Desmond reached in his pocket and pulled out his most precious possession. It was the Bible Dorothy had given him after they were married. In it, she had marked a truly appropriate verse, 1 Corinthians 10:13, for encouragement. He read it again. "There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that ye may be able to bear it." Then he turned to the first page. There was a letter she had written in the Bible before presenting it to him. As the train carried him westward, each click of the wheels beneath him taking him farther and farther away from the woman he loved, Desmond read, as he had so many times before, the words she had written. November 22, 1942. Dearest Desmond, as you read and study the precious promises found in the Word of God contained in this little Bible, may you be strengthened in whatever trials may come to you. May your faith in God bring comfort and peace of heart to you, that you may never be sad or lonely, no matter how dark the way seems. If we do not meet another time on this earth, we have the assurance of a happy meeting place in heaven. May God, in His mercy, grant us both a place there. Your loving wife, Dorothy. Desmond closed the Bible and put it back in his pocket over his heart. What a wonderful letter. Once again, he drew courage and comfort from it. He sighed, and, as the train picked up speed, he went back to his potatoes. And so, he was off to war.
Chapter 3. Combat. A heavy sea was running, and the big transport ship pitched and rolled like a crazy sea monster. At her side, but far beneath, the landing craft bobbed and wallowed erratically in the gray-green Pacific. A driving rain beat against the ponchos, helmets, and unprotected faces of the men. It obscured the distant shoreline, and the howling wind muffled the sounds of artillery fire and exploding shells.
"Okay, 2nd Platoon, start loading!"
Lieutenant Willis A.J. Munger, the fresh-faced young officer who was replacing Lieutenant Gornto temporarily, slung his leg over the rail. The other men followed. Now, it was Doss's turn. On his back was his field pack, his canteen and shovel on his belt. From each shoulder hung a big canvas first aid kit. Carrying more than 75 pounds, the driving rain beating into his face, his cold, wet hands clutching the rail, the ship bucking and rearing, he felt with his feet for the thick rope of the landing net slung on the side of the ship. He found a foothold and began the long climb down to the landing craft.
"All aboard, sir!"
a voice shouted.
"Cast off!"
The boat slowly moved away from the parent ship and headed towards the rendezvous point, pitching and tossing in the waves. Now up with a swoosh, now down with a sickening lift in the pit of the stomach. It wasn't long before nausea gripped even the toughest men. Lieutenant Munger, younger than most of the men he commanded, tried to keep his dignity, but his face was turning green. Wretched and miserable in the open boat in the driving rain, Desmond Doss and his 2nd platoon proceeded to their first action. It was a dramatic, daring operation. If successful, it would extend the American spearhead a full 1,000 miles deep into the Japanese-held island area between Japan itself and the Caroline Islands. The 77th's objective was Guam, largest of the Marianas, and an American possession which the Japanese had taken shortly after Pearl Harbor. Ever since the arrival in Hawaii on April 1, 1944, 2 years to the day after Desmond's induction, the 77th had been training for this operation, the assault on a fortified island. Part of the preparation had involved the arming of all medical soldiers. Tragic experience had shown the American Army that the Japanese were instructed to seek out and kill medical soldiers in the correct assumption that it would affect morale. The battalion executive officer, Colonel Gerald G. Cooney, had ordered Doss to carry a weapon, and on his refusal had recommended that he be returned to the States. Captain Vernon, B Company's CO, had interceded at the last moment, and Desmond remained with the company. Now, approaching Guam, Desmond was not so sure that staying had been a good idea. It was an actual relief when the LCI scraped the coral reef some 400 yards from the beach. The ramp was lowered, and one of the men gingerly dropped himself into the water. It was up to his chin. Doss went in up to his armpits. Some of the shorter men, weighed down with pack, rifle, and ammunition, had to be helped on the long, sloshing walk to shore. Weakened by nausea, exhausted after waiting a quarter of a mile, the men of B Company assembled on the beach. The American soldiers who had fallen on the first assault had been removed, but Japanese bodies lay everywhere. They lay in twisted positions, on front and back, in and out of mud holes. Desmond tried not to look at the bodies. The army had tried to teach him to hate the enemy, but it had not been successful. Desmond checked with his buddies, Glenn and Doris. They had reached the shore safely. With Captain Vernon at the head, the company started a 5-mile hike to their bivouac area. Under the combination of heavy tanks and the tropical downpour, the trail was a series of mud holes, some waist deep. When they reached the area, the men were at the limit of their endurance. Desmond opened his package of K rations. It contained a chunk of cheese with bacon in it, As he could not eat pork, he gave it away to those who could, and started munching on the hard, tasteless crackers that came in the package. The GIs called them dog biscuits. The K-ration package also contained cigarettes and coffee. Not approving of either, Desmond threw them both away. A moral luxury that would not last too many days. They could be traded for another dog biscuit or a candy bar. The 1st Battalion of the 307th Infantry, which included Company B, was being held in reserve. And for 4 days, the cold, wet soldiers sat huddled in their ponchos by day, shivered in holes that had to be constantly bailed out by night. Their uniforms, green cotton fatigues, never dried out. Their feet were always wet. Then came orders to move out, and to move out fast. The mission was to cross the narrow island to the east, then drive northward to the crossroads of Barragata. This was a vital point. A functioning well was located there. In spite of all that rain, the invasion forces were running out of water. There were few wells on this coral island. Barragata had to be taken. It was about 8 miles across the island, another 5 up to Barragata. These are crow's flight distances. The actual mileage around hills and over winding jungle trails was much further. Nor was the terrain secure. In the haste to get water, the forward elements were driving straight through, bypassing Japanese snipers, rearguard patrols, and even large pockets of the enemy. The battalion traveled as a self-contained unit. As it passed through, the jungle closed up after it. There was nobody behind. Desmond chose his position at about 2/3 back from the head of the platoon. It would be pointless for him to march at the front, not only because he was a high-priority target, but because he could not watch his men from there. But it would also be unwise to bring up the rear. They pushed along briskly. An occasional sniper's bullet whistled by, but no one in the platoon was injured. The men watched where they put their feet and were careful to touch nothing. They had been warned against booby traps. The Japanese even booby-trapped their own dead. Roll a corpse over, and a grenade would go off. But of course, no Japanese would drop an American fountain pen. One of the men saw it, lying, bright and shiny by the trail. He was a happy-go-lucky, impulsive kid. "Hey, look at that!" he cried. "A fountain pen!" 3 of the men who were near him stopped and joined him as he picked it up. Suddenly, an explosion shook the jungle. The pen had triggered a white phosphorus grenade. Desmond heard the cry, "Medic! Das! Das!" He hurried forward. He smelled the burning flesh before he reached the men. White phosphorus sticks to the skin as it burns with a white heat. The man who had picked up the pen had taken most of the blast. His torso was a bloody mess. The other men were suffering from severe burns and wounds caused by pieces of flying metal. Desmond slung off his first aid kits and went to work. The man who had activated the booby trap was in the worst shape. He had lost a lot of blood, was critically burned, and was already in a state of shock. Desmond staunched the blood flow and treated the burns. Another man was also in bad shape. Desmond treated him next. The other 2 were better off. By the time he had finished, 4 litter bearers had come up. They would carry the 2 seriously injured men back to the battalion aid station. The other 2 were classified as walking wounded and traveled under their own power. Not until it was over did Desmond realize that he had treated his first casualties. He had not panicked. If the 2 badly injured men lived, it would be because of his prompt, efficient action. Before starting after his unit, Desmond paused to give thanks to the Lord for enabling him to do his job. Desmond caught up with the 2nd platoon before nightfall. They were getting close to the main Japanese forces now, passing abandoned equipment in bivouac areas where the fires were still warm. That night, 7 Japanese were killed trying to infiltrate the company area. There had been no official water for days, and the men had gotten what they could where they could. As a result, nearly everyone suffered from nausea, headaches, and diarrhea. They could appreciate the need to capture Barragata. The battle order came down. The 2nd platoon was in the very center of the battalion front, headed on a crossroads. They dashed through the jungle. Suddenly, PFC Julian R. Perez, the platoon scout, started firing. A light machine gun opened up. PFC Angelo B. Pacella went down. Lieutenant Munger halted the advance and sent a group of men around on each side to envelop the machine gun. They knocked it out, and the advance continued. The battle grew hotter. Several companies were now involved, all of them blasting away. The Japanese returned the fire. Doss scooped out a little hole and made himself as small as possible. Down the road, he saw a green-clad American soldier jump up and start running forward in a crouching position. Suddenly, he went down and lay motionless. Out of nowhere, an officer, obviously the fallen soldier's company commander, came running, standing straight up, waving his hands and shouting the man's name. Desmond began running toward him too, but he kept low. The soldier was lying on his face where he had fallen. Desmond crossed one of the soldier's legs over the other and turned him so that he lay face up. Blood was all over the man's chest. His captain looked on helplessly. Desmond took both hands and ripped the fatigue jacket open. A shell fragment had torn a big hole in the victim's chest. The medic knew there was little he could do, but he opened up his kit and took out a large battle dressing just the same. As he was putting it in place, the soldier let out his last dying breath. He was dead. Desmond breathed one short, quick, but fervent prayer. Then he and the captain sped back toward cover. Not until after Desmond had dived into the jungle underbrush and gasped for breath did he realize that he had just lost his first American soldier. In front of Barragata lay a large clearing. On the other side stood a deserted green shack.
"That looks like good protection," Munger said. "Let's take it."
Munger and Perez, crouching low and zigzagging, ran across the field to the shack. The other men of the platoon, in groups of twos and threes, followed. Suddenly, an enemy tank, the machine gun on its turret hammering out fire and death, came through the village and roared up to the regimental command post, leaving wounded and dead men in its wake. Two men from the second platoon had been hit. The Japanese started pasting the green shack with mortar and artillery.
"Anyone who wants to go can leave. I wouldn't blame you," Munger told his men. "But I'm sticking."
The men stuck with him. Sergeant Charles J. Kuntz volunteered to go for reinforcements. He dashed across the open field and reported the situation to Captain Vernon.
"Tell Munger to come back," Vernon said. "That shack isn't worth it."
Kuntz dashed across the field again, delivered the message. As other members of the company, under fire, covered them, Munger led his men out of the shack. He was hit and fell. Dead. Perez and Kuntz were wounded, but the Japanese attack was beaten off. The next morning, the village was taken, along with the well and a small reservoir of water. After the Americans secured the village, they collected the dead and placed them together. Some of the native Chamorros had also lost their lives in the battle. Desmond was walking near the collection area when he heard a slight moan. He thought he saw one of the natives stir. These people had been of great help to the Americans. Desmond went to the man and knelt by his side. He could feel no pulse. He placed his finger gently on the carotid artery in the neck. There was the slightest sensation of movement. The man was still alive. Desmond examined him, found the wound, and treated it. He then checked all the bodies. Another, an American, was also alive. Desmond had both men taken to the battalion aid station. From then on, he never gave up on any man until positive he was dead.
"Haven't you got enough to do, taking care of our own men?" Glenn asked. "Why try to resurrect these natives?"
"Because it's not up to me to judge whether one of God's children should live or die," Desmond said. "That is a decision for the Lord to make, not me. I believe that I should do everything in my power to help all men hold on to life."
"Suppose they aren't fit to live?"
"Well, the way I look at it," Desmond said, "is that anybody who isn't fit to live surely isn't fit to die. What worse fate could possibly happen to any mortal than to die when he doesn't deserve to live? That would seal his doom forever. No matter how evil a person may be, he deserves to live, for he may discover the teachings of Jesus and be saved."
At Barragata, the 307th lost 85 men killed and wounded. The miserable conditions, constant rain, polluted water, clouds of flies and mosquitoes, also took their toll in sickness. But the push against the Japanese continued. Patrols constantly probed ahead of the advancing line. If they found no resistance, the larger bodies of troops moved up. If they met resistance, then the decision had to be made by the higher echelons when to attack and in what strength. Whenever the 2nd Platoon was assigned a patrol mission, Desmond went along with his men. His old friend, Sergeant Howell, one of the senior non-coms at the battalion aid station, heard that Desmond was going out on patrol with the dog faces.
"Have you lost your mind, Doss?"
he demanded.
"It's not your job to get killed. Your job is to stay alive so that you can help these men when they get hit. If Captain Vernon or anybody else tries to send you on patrol, you tell him it's not your duty."
"It may not be my duty," Desmond told him. "But it's what I believe in. I know these men. They're my buddies. They have families. Some have wives and children. If they're hurt, I want to be there to take care of them."
He continued to go out on patrol, slipping noiselessly through the jungles, maintaining constant visual contact with the men in front of him, peering about for any suspicious activity, ever alert to the danger of booby traps and mines. If the patrol was fired upon and a man was hit, the other men would close in and cover Doss while he administered first aid. Then they'd all retreat together, helping the wounded man to safety. even when they encountered no opposition, the patrols were more efficient with Doss along. He gave the men confidence. Even the bravest soldier has a horror of being wounded and left behind, helpless, at the mercy of the enemy. For the enemy had no mercy. But with Doss along, that fear was alleviated, for they knew their medic wouldn't leave them. Captain Vernon and the other officers came to expect Doss to go with the men. Vernon himself, as brave and as fair as any officer in the army, went out himself, and he expected no less of any of his men. And yet friction developed between the brave captain and the brave medic. When a man received a slight wound that might become infected, when he was so sick with fever or diarrhea that he couldn't do his job, Doss insisted that he return to the battalion aid station to be checked by a medical officer. Sometimes the man did not return. Captain Vernon felt that Doss was over-solicitous. He himself would fight on as long as he was conscious, and he expected his men to do the same.
"That man wasn't badly hurt," he raged at Doss one day. "You didn't have to send him back."
"He needed more attention than I could give him, Captain," Doss said quietly. "I didn't have any choice."
"You pill rollers are mollycoddling these men," Vernon said. "We're fighting a war up here, not running a hospital."
"Captain," Doss said, "some of these men are so sick they couldn't do you or themselves any good. On patrol, they don't know what they're doing. They'll get themselves and the rest of us killed."
In the meantime, pressure was coming on him from another direction.
"What's this I hear about you going out on patrols?"
Captain Leo Tan, the medical officer at the battalion aid station, said.
"You can't do anybody any good if you get shot yourself. Leave the patrols to the riflemen. You stay in the company area where you belong."
Desmond had been at the aid station picking up supplies. When he returned to the company, he found that his platoon had been moved out. He set out through the jungle, trying to overtake them, but he had gone only a couple hundred yards when another officer in the company saw him.
"Get back, Doss," he said. "There are Japanese all through here."
"But I'm trying to find my platoon," Doss said.
"They're way up ahead now,"
the officer said.
"You'd never make it alive. Get back. That's an order."
Back at the company area, Desmond had a feeling of unease, as though something was going to happen. That night, he uttered a special prayer to the Lord for his men. He had never failed to say his daily prayers, incidentally, morning and evening. He even returned thanks when he munched dog biscuits and washed them down with foul-tasting water. But he no longer knelt at all times. On the front, there was constant danger of Japanese infiltrating past the company perimeter. Standing orders were to shoot at anything that moved. If Desmond had stuck his head out of his hole, he would likely have gotten shot off. And so, he reasoned, God would hear his prayers whether he was standing, kneeling, or lying shivering in a muddy hole. That night, he asked the Lord that, if it were his will, he give special protection to the men of the 2nd Platoon. In the morning, Lieutenant George M. Black, who had replaced Lieutenant Munger, burst into the company area with two of his men. All three had been slightly wounded.
"An artillery and mortar barrage zeroed in on us and kept it up all night," Black reported. "Several of our men were hit. They need attention."
Desmond threw his first aid kits over his shoulders.
"I'm ready, sir," he said.
The lieutenant led the medic and a squad of riflemen back to the platoon. Snipers fired on them all the way. Several men were injured, and Desmond dressed their wounds. From their description of the barrage, he knew that it was a miracle that any man had lived. Yet of the entire platoon, only one man lost his life. When he had treated the last wounded man, Desmond Doss bowed his head and humbly gave thanks to the Lord for hearing his prayer. On the way back, he was twice as vulnerable to the sniper's bullets, for now he was helping one of his men, who hobbled with a leg wound. The two made their way through the jungle, with the wounded man hopping on one leg, his arm around Desmond's neck for support. A dozen times, bullets whistled through the foliage, and the two dropped to the ground. It was a long trip, and a painful one, but they reached the company area safely. 2 days later, the company was together again. Again, a 2nd platoon patrol went out, this time without their medic. When Captain Vernon learned that Desmond had not accompanied the patrol, he told him to catch up with it. By that time, the patrol was deep in the woods. Japanese snipers were all through that area. Even more dangerous, Doss knew, were the green replacements in the patrol. They'd shoot at anything.
"It's too late to go now, Captain," Desmond said. "If the Japanese don't get me, the new men will."
"Do you refuse to go?" Vernon demanded.
"Captain, I'd just get myself killed, and I'm under orders not to take that kind of chance."
Vernon blew up.
"I'm gonna have you court-martialed," he shouted. "You shanker mechanics have to take orders like everybody else."
Desmond hurried to the battalion aid station to report the situation to Captain Tan. The medical officer, in turn, immediately made a report to regimental headquarters.
Tan had heard of Vernon's references to his medics as pill rollers and shanker mechanics and was annoyed with him. There was no court-martial, and Captain Vernon was officially informed that Doss took orders from the medical battalion, not the officers of B Company. The episode officially closed, but Desmond knew it had rankled the captain. Desmond himself, about this time, learned something about the responsibility of command. The battalion was cleaning up sporadic resistance north of Barragata. It moved swiftly as a self-contained unit. The jungle closed up behind it as it passed. Suddenly, shots rang out. Ambush! 4 men were seriously wounded. Desmond got to them first and gave them emergency treatment. By now, nearly all the battalion had gone by. What would Desmond do with the wounded men? They could not walk, and he couldn't leave them there. While he worked on them, some men came by with litters and dropped 4. Then came the rearguard. After that, there was nobody, except perhaps the Japanese. The rearguard was under the command of an infantry sergeant. Desmond didn't know him, but he knew the sergeant would have to be tough and competent to be entrusted with so critical an assignment.
"I need some of your men to carry these wounded," Doss told him.
"Are you crazy? This is the rear guard. I can't spare any men."
"You've got to. Do you think I'm going to leave these men here to die?"
"I can't help that," the sergeant snapped. "All I know is I can't leave any men."
He was shouting, and Desmond shouted right back.
"I'm a medical soldier, and this is an emergency, and I'm ordering you to help me carry these wounded American soldiers. And if you don't, I'm going to get your name and serial number, and you'll be busted right down to private."
"Well, I've got to ask the lieutenant. He's gone on."
"Okay, then.
Go ask,"
Desmond agreed. "But leave some men here until you come back." The sergeant started running up the trail after the lieutenant. The jungle became quiet. There was only a handful of men and the wounded, and they all kept looking about apprehensively. But the sergeant came running back.
"All right," the sergeant panted. "The lieutenant says, take what you need, but make it snappy. Let's get out of here."
4 men quickly grabbed the handles of each litter and set off at a quick step along the trail. Desmond stuck with them until he could transfer the casualties, all still alive, to the rear. The campaign on Guam was drawing to a close. Only mopping up operations remained. The 77th Division moved into a bivouac area for a rest and to break in the new replacements. And Captain Tan summoned Desmond to the aid station.
"I'm having you transferred out of Company B," he said. "You'll be a litter bearer working out of this aid station. If Captain Vernon doesn't know what to do with the best company aid man in the army, well, I do."
Desmond packed up his things and moved in with the medical battalion. He had several friends there. One of them was a litter bearer named Herbert Schechter. Herb was a short, chunky fellow with black curly hair. He was quiet, sincere, and religious. Like Desmond, he observed the Sabbath, but as a Jew, not an Adventist. The two young men liked to discuss religion, finding pleasure in their close agreement on many philosophical points.
"Boy, am I glad to see you,"
Herb cried.
"I bet you're not sorry to be out of that outfit."
"No, I guess not,"
Desmond said. But deep inside, he wasn't so sure. Up there with the fighting men, he felt he could best serve his fellow men and his country, and therefore his God. Perhaps it was where he belonged. Chapter 4. Pray for me, Doss. Nothing is so restful as a tropical ocean cruise, and during most of the month of November, the combat-weary men of the 77th Division lazed their way through long, uneventful days and tropical, star-filled nights. As the big transport plowed on smoothly southward towards the rest area on New Caledonia, Desmond liked to get out of the smoky bowels of the ship at night and lie on the deck in the balmy equatorial climate, the bright stars just out of reach above him. For the first time in months, the men had plenty of good fresh food to eat, and Doss felt the strength come back into his weary muscles. During the day, he caught up on his Bible course, brief Bible studies for busy people. He had been studying his Bible for as long as he could remember, and he welcomed the opportunity to spend hours a day with this reliable old friend. This was the Bible Dorothy had given him, and often he would turn to that letter she had written. Though she was a third of a world away, the opening salutation, "Dearest Desmond," written in her beloved, familiar hand, made her seem closer. As he studied his Bible, other men frequently came up and discussed religion with him. Desmond had written out many of the answers to the most common questions asked of him on small pieces of paper, and had tucked them in the appropriate places in the Bible. He could turn to the proper place, flick his eye over what he had written, and give the correct answer almost instantaneously. The word passed all over the ship that here was a man who really knew his Bible. A passage he found strangely heartening was the prophecy of wars and rumor of wars and other dire events in Matthew chapter 24. With other Adventists, he interpreted this to mean that after this period of world calamity, Christ will come again. Not everyone agreed with him that the war was really a fine omen, however. Mostly, of course, Desmond talked with his old buddies, Glenn and Doris and Herb Schechter, but frequently other men would come and discuss theology with him. One of the officers of B Company, Lieutenant Kenneth Phillips, a devout Presbyterian from North Carolina, also liked to talk religion. Desmond did not see much of the other officers. Captain Vernon remained especially aloof, and most of the other officers of B Company followed his lead. Desmond missed the close camaraderie he had enjoyed with the men of the 2nd Platoon and B Company, but he saw no point in crying over it. He would continue to do his best to serve God and his fellow man and his country and hope that everything would work out all right. 4 days out of New Caledonia, the convoy suddenly made a sweeping turn and headed toward the northwest. Within minutes, the news was all over Desmond's transport. There would be no rest on New Caledonia for the weary men of the 77th. The division was heading for the island of Leyte in the Philippines. The news came as no great surprise. Broadcasts picked up by the ship's radio told how the American advance had slowed down on Leyte. The Japanese High Command had publicly stated its intention to make the Leyte campaign the decisive one of the Philippine Islands. The Japanese were putting everything they had on this small strategic island south of Luzon. On the way north, the convoy stopped in at the island of Manus to pick up replacements and supplies. Then on to the east coast of Leyte, where the division landed on an already secured beachhead. This was now the rainy season, with water everywhere. In the sky, in the air, on the ground. The rice paddies were all flooded, knee-deep in muddy water, and the roads were not much better. Dry feet became an almost impossible luxury. 2 weeks after landing on Leyte, the troops were hastily recalled in great secrecy, loaded on board transports again, and taken around the southern tip of the island. When the transports put to sea, officers and men were gathered into groups over the ship and briefed on the coming mission by a plans and trainings officer over the public address system. The situation was this. The Japanese, in large numbers, were resisting strongly in the area around Ormoc, in the northwest portion of the island. Americans pressed against them from the north, south, and east. The 77th would come in by sea from the west. Desmond and every man in the medical battalion knew there would be heavy fighting against strong resistance and many casualties. Desmond had mixed emotions about his new assignment. Though there were many new faces in both B Company and the 2nd Platoon, some of the old-timers remained. It would be more dangerous, up there with the combat men, but Desmond was prepared for that type of work and believed he could be of greater service there. Not that his new designation as a litter-bearer was any picnic in combat. He was expected to go where the wounded lay and bring them back to the aid station for treatment, as he would be working out of the 1st Battalion aid station, which served companies A, B, C, and D. He would still have some contact with his old unit. Before dawn on the morning of December 8, cruisers and battleships of the United States Navy began a thunderous barrage against the coastline south of Ormoc. Desmond was in one of the first assault waves. Landing craft filled with soldiers shoved ahead, right into that inferno. Not until minutes before the first assault wave hit the beach did the big guns let up. Rockets continued to pass overhead, bursting behind the beaches. They made a frightening sound as they flashed overhead. This time, the LCIs let down their landing ramps in shallow water, almost on the beach. The men poured off and ran lickety-split across the open beach towards the wall of jungle. Desmond's unit was lucky. They met virtually no opposition from the Japanese. It was later discovered that the Japanese were expecting reinforcements to be landed on that coast. They thought the landing was made by their own forces. The 1st Battalion pressed on, crossing a road, slopping across a rice paddy, until it made contact with Japanese outposts at the village of Itil south of Ormoc. It took 2 days to secure Itil. On the afternoon of the 8th, orders came down to B Company to advance across a stream and take the hill on the other side. D Company's machine guns furnished cover.
When about half the company had crossed the stream, Captain Vernon received orders to pull the entire company all the way back to battalion headquarters. Confusion resulted. Some men still fought their way up the hill, while others pulled back.
What's it all about, anyway?
Lieutenant Gorinto demanded.
The Japs are counterattacking on our right rear, Vernon said. We've got to help beat them off.
Mortar shells began falling among the machine gunners on the hillside, trying to protect the retreat. A shell fragment hit one of them in the head. His helmet went flying, and blood gushed down into his eyes.
Medic! Medic!
The cry went up. Clarence Glenn heard the call. He and most of his company had now fallen back safely. He should have stayed with his own men, but again the call came. Glenn left his cover and dashed out into the open toward the wounded man. 10 yards before he reached his side, Glenn went down and lay motionless. Now the machine gunners were ordered to fall back, and they did so, leaving the two Americans lying there. Nobody knew whether they were alive or dead. Word that Glenn was hit got back to Desmond Doss at the battalion aid station. Memories raced through his head. He, Glenn, and Doris, and their wives, together in the States. He thought of Glenn's wife and baby back home, and he knew he couldn't leave him there.
"I'm going after him," he said.
"There's another man out there, too,"
somebody said.
"The one Glenn went after."
"I'll go with you, Doss," Herb Schechter offered.
It was several hundred yards to the point where the two men had fallen. Only a few yards farther, the jungle began. The Americans had pulled out. The Japanese were most assured.